You are listening to the podcast of Called to Communion. More podcasts and other information can be found at www.calledtocommunion.com.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 13 of Called to Communion podcast. I am Tom Riello, your host for our monthly endeavor. And joining us this time is Tim Troutman. Tim is a regular contributor here at Called to Communion. And Tim has recently written an article on apostolic succession and the priesthood. And Tim, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Well, Tim, let's get right into the article that you just posted on the website. Many Protestant denominations have different views about how church ministers should be ordained and how church leadership should be structured. Yet, in spite of these differences, a Presbyterian may very well consider a Baptist to be part of the true church. In the Protestant mind, these questions can sometimes be secondary. Why is it important to talk about holy orders?
Well, Tom, when we discuss holy orders, I think a lot of Protestants do think it's a secondary issue. For example, one of the commenters on the post that I wrote was or said something to the effect that, you know, I agree with most of these things, but in reality, I don't think he does. And I went back and showed here's why I don't think you agree with this. And if you do, you should be Catholic, because a validly ordained minister, you know, consists in these things here. So, for example, only a bishop could ordain. And that's important. If we say that no one is validly ordained except for he who is ordained by a bishop, that's extremely important, because if that's true, well, then there are no validly ordained Presbyterian ministers. There are no validly ordained Lutheran ministers. And we could, you know, I understand that there's some debate about that, and there are some Lutherans who believe they have a claim to apostolic succession. But certainly for any kind of evangelical pastor, there's no question that his ordination would be invalid if it's true that only a validly ordained bishop can ordain. So that's one of the aspects that's extremely important about holy orders, and that's why this discussion is important. So we began with laying out the hierarchy of the church. Before we get into apostolic succession per se, we're starting with a very important and fundamental issue of holy orders. What is the exact structure that Christ intended for his church? Is that important? Yes, absolutely. It's very important.
Well, your second section of your article argues that there is a distinction between the clergy and the laity. Wouldn't many Protestants also grant this point as well?
Well, again, I think they would. Some of them would grant that, yes, but they grant it in sort of a nominal fashion. That there is a difference. But for example, Martin Luther said there is a difference between the clergy and the laity, but only in respect to the task that they are given to do. So in other words, there's not an essential difference. And there's some truth in what he's saying. It's not entirely false. Of course, if we were to look at a cleric and a layperson in the eyes of God in regard to salvation or in regard to being a sinner, of course, they're both equal. There's no difference there. And the difference between what they are given to do, it's true, but it's incomplete. It's not just that this person happens to be the priest and this other person happens to be the layperson, and they both need to just kind of do their duty. Well, instead, there's an actual difference in what they are able to do. And we see this continually throughout the fathers. The fathers didn't believe that just anyone could walk off the street and say a prayer of consecration and have the Eucharist. No, only a validly ordained priest could do that. And that's the same today. So that's an essential difference between the clergy and the laity. The cleric can consecrate the Eucharist. The cleric can forgive sins, because remember, Jesus told the disciples, I give you the power to forgive sins. And so that mediation of forgiveness of sins comes through the cleric, not through a layperson. So we believe that they have different different powers that the lay persons don't have. So I think, you know, some Protestants would say that there's an essential difference, but they don't mean it in the same way that we Catholics mean it when we say there's an essential distinction between the clergy and the laity.
Well, and you know, I think for myself, having received ordination in the New York Presbytery, you know, once I demitted the ministry, I lost, if you will, that ordination. And so, in a certain sense, it would seem that, you know, ordination in a Protestant, certainly in the Presbyterian world, is more functional than it is, say, in the Catholic understanding, you know, where, God forbid, if a priest does leave the clerical state, he still retains within him the ordination, you know, that he has been set apart, and an indelible mark has been placed upon his soul. So I think even there, it's a real question of, you know, how we see the difference in how Protestants, or certainly at least the Presbyterians, understand ordination compared to, say, the Catholic does.
That's right, yeah. That's another good point, is the indelibility of the sacrament. You know, St. Augustine said that both baptism and holy orders are sacraments, and he said that, and no one doubts this. Of course, that was back then. People do doubt it now. But at the time of St. Augustine, no one in the Catholic Church doubted that both holy orders and baptism were both sacraments. And, you know, he makes a point, well, baptism is indelible, so is holy orders.
Yeah, I think even I think St. Augustine even refers to those who were ordained and say who maybe followed a heresy. When they come back in, they're for the reason that you just mentioned, they are not to be reordained. Nothing is new to take place.
That's right.
You make the claim that the three-tiered hierarchy of the church, bishop, presbyter, and deacon, is of divine and not ecclesial origin. Many modern scholars argue that the interchangeability of the terms bishop and presbyter in the New Testament shows that the distinction between the office came later. Is there any credibility in the belief that the earliest ministers were all presbyters and that they eventually started electing bishops?
Well, there's several problems with that theory. First of all, with the divine origin versus ecclesial origin, this has to be sort of understood in a qualified sense. I don't want to use that word, but when we say divine origin, we don't mean that it was necessarily instituted directly by Jesus Christ. So in other words, when the Protestants talk about a sacrament, for example, one of their key marks is that the sacrament was instituted immediately by Jesus Christ. And that's not really part of the discussion here, but when we say divine origin, we mean that it was intended by Christ, although it might not have been effected directly by him. It might have been intended by him and effected through the apostles, or by the apostles under the influence of the Holy Spirit. So we see that with the ordination of the deacons, right?
Yes, yes.
We, of course, believe that the ordination of deacons was divine origin. This is not something that the church just kind of invented apart from Christ or apart from the will of Christ. No, Christ knew and intended that there would be deacons in the church. And even though Jesus Christ himself didn't establish deacons, he didn't intend that. And those whom he gave authority, the apostles, did it under the influence of the Holy Spirit. And we read about this in Acts chapter 6. And the same thing potentially could have happened with the bishops and presbyters. So regarding the belief that the earliest ministers were all presbyters, we have no positive proof for that. Let's just get that right on the table. There's no positive evidence that we can point to. What we have is a lot of arguments from silence and some arguments from confusion. For example, the interchangeability or the apparent interchangeability of the terms in the New Testament and in the earliest patristic writing. The bishop and presbyter appear to be used interchangeably. So some, you know, Peter refers to himself as a fellow elder. At one time, Paul addresses the bishops, I think, at the city of Philippi. So, you know, those two terms seem to be used interchangeably. But I make the argument in the paper that there are several explanations for that. Number one, the terms were undergoing a technicalization of terminology. So they weren't, just because a term appears in the New Testament, that doesn't mean that it's absolutely understood as a universally technical term at that point. Now, because we're used to using bishop and presbyter as technical terms, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very tempting when we read this to think that they mean the same thing that we do. Well, that's not necessarily the case, as any etymologist can tell you, that that's not how language works. One example of this that someone brought up on another post related to a reply to this article is that in the book of Acts, in chapter 6, when they ordain the deacons, the word deacon is never used. But we almost certainly know that the word deacon is already a technical term in some spheres at that time. So Paul was already using the term deacon as a technical term. So it's interesting that the Acts doesn't use that there when the church has universally recognized that ordination of the seven in Jerusalem as the installation of the first deacons. So the word deacon just means minister. So originally it's not a technical term. So anyway, those are just some examples. I think you'd really need to go into the article to see the depth of the argument with the technicalization of terminology. That's point number one. Another point is that we know for absolute certain that by the late second century, the entire church had accepted the monepiscopacy. We know and have good reason. Well, we know that it was certainly in place in Asia Minor, which was one of the most populated Christian areas, in the year 107 AD when St. Ignatius writes his letters. And most scholars that I know of would accept that it was universal by the mid-second century. So what we have is this broad acceptance and a widespread acceptance without any, we don't have any record of any protest whatsoever by the faithful. And so it's inconceivable that this doctrine of the monepiscopacy, presbyters united under one bishop, was universally accepted throughout the entire church without any protest in such a short amount of time. I mean, this happened almost immediately. I mean, we're talking just within a generation. The entire church had gone from presbyters equally voting on things to one bishop over the entire, the local church. And what we also learned from the patristic writing from there on out is that not only was there one bishop in charge of everything, but the presbyters had very limited authority to begin with. In the first century, it was uncommon or almost unheard of for a presbyter even to give a homily.
Mm-hmm.
The presbyter would not consecrate the Eucharist. The presbyter would not. It doesn't appear that the presbyters even distributed the Eucharist in the beginning. Saint Ignatius, in his letters, says that let that Eucharist be considered valid, which is consecrated by the bishop or by someone who the bishop has authorized. And so the church had understood that the presbyters had a growing participation in the ministry of the bishop. So the presbyter could consecrate Eucharist, but only by extension of the ministry of the bishop. The bishop is properly the priest of the church, and the powers were gradually delegated to the presbyters over time. Why is this significant? Well, if the power was originally with the presbyters and they had all the power of the church or all the power of the clergy originally, and then they decided to elect one of them as the bishop, then it seems extremely backwards that as soon as they do that, all of a sudden they all believe universally, they all believe that, okay, now we don't have any power anymore of our own. Only the bishop has the power. And in order for us to have that authority, we have to get it from him. It's really a backwards way of thinking about things. This scenario is implausible for those reasons. So I don't think there's any good arguments for the idea that presbyters and bishops were the same. Now, with that said, let me make an important distinction that I think is often lost in this conversation. Let's think about what does the monepiscopacy require to be true? What would falsify that? Well, the theory that we just spoke about would falsify monepiscopacy if the presbyters, the second tier of the hierarchy, originally were the only people there and they elected one of theirs as the bishop and then they gave him the authority of the successor to the apostles. If that happened, then that would sort of falsify the monepiscopacy. But again, we have no indication that that did happen. Some of this may simply be in the terms themselves. So what we were saying, presbyter and bishop, were these both the same thing? Well, maybe. It depends on what you mean by presbyter and bishop. Here's all that the monepiscopacy requires to be true. Number one, it requires that there was always a time when there were were some ordained Christians who had all the powers of the clergy, that is, the power to confer holy orders, the power to ordain, the power to consecrate the Eucharist, and the power to administer the other sacraments. As long as there was always someone with that authority, that whoever that person was is what we would now call a bishop. Now, they, at that point in time, they may have referred to him as something else. They might have called him a presbyter. It doesn't matter. Well, what matters is we're not interested in merely the sounds of the words. We're interested in what the words are referring to, those realities, the reality of the distinction between one person who has the full authority of the apostles, the full episcopal power, and then someone who doesn't have that power or doesn't have the fullness or is a second tier. And it is also possible that initially every ordained minister who was not a deacon had that power, because in Saint Clement of Rome, when he writes in 96 A.D., he also appears to use the terms interchangeably. When he uses the word bishop, he doesn't use it in the same passage with presbyter, but he does say bishops and deacons. So maybe he thinks that initially there were only bishops and deacons installed. Okay, if that's the case, that doesn't falsify the monepiscopacy, because it could be that either initially only bishops were ordained, like Titus and Timothy, for example, and then later the apostles instructed those same bishops, or the apostles themselves ordained presbyters, that is, ordained ministers with a lower grade of authority, or instructed the bishops that they installed to ordain men to the second tier of authority. It appears to me that the apostles did ordained presbyters, and some of those were later elevated to the episcopacy, for example, St. Clement of Rome. Anyway, so we're taking all this together, and I make a much clearer case of this, I think, in the article. I don't think that there's any good evidence for our original collegial presbyterate government that elected a bishop. In fact, I think there's good evidence against that, and I go through this in the article.
You know, you mentioned about the whole notion of the presbyter and the bishops. You know, Athanasius speaks of a certain Ischyrus who claimed to have been a presbyter, and he was ordained by the presbyter Colluthus, who pretended to the episcopate. And then Athanasius goes on to say how that means, therefore, that Ischyrus is not a clergyman. He's just a layman. So it demonstrates what you're saying. And, you know, the other thing you're talking about, too, we even see this today in the Catholic Church. Maybe a lot of our listeners who are not Catholic may not be aware of it, and even some Catholics. But when a man is presented to the diaconate and even to the priesthood, he's granted faculties. And so it is possible, when we think of, the soon-to-be-beatified Solanus Casey, he was ordained to the priesthood, but he was not given faculties. Certain faculties to hear confessions, for example, and he wasn't given the faculty to do a homily. The question is, where does that come from? Well, it sounds like from what you're saying that it comes from antiquity. It comes from the history of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this whole notion of sacrificial priesthood and holy orders, you speak of that. Why is it important to talk about both of these at the same time?
Well, I don't think I did justice to the nature of the sacrificial nature of the priesthood in the article. There's certainly a lot more that could be said, and I hope that we will have. I mean, I'm certain we'll be talking about that in articles to come, because it's an integral aspect of the priesthood. You know, one of the things I mentioned is the word priest. Okay, the English word priest, it means someone who offers sacrifice, right? Well, in the old Greek word presbyter, or presbyteros, which is the Greek, and the Latin form of it is a presbyter, it didn't mean someone who offered sacrifice. It meant someone, it just meant an elder, so it could be just an old man. So the Protestants have used this, or especially Reformed have used this, to show that this means that they're not priests in the way we would refer to them. They were just ministers. The problem with this is, okay, eventually the church did start calling, referring to their presbyters as the Greek word for priest, or the Latin word sacerdos. They did start doing that, but the concept was always there from the beginning. And the word presbyter, the church continued to use the word presbyter long after they started calling, referring to them as hierius, the Greek hierius, or the Latin sacerdos. Long after they started using those words to refer to the priests and the bishops, they continued to use the word presbyter. How long did they keep using it? Well, they never stopped using it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we still use it. The word priest is actually the word presbyter that has just evolved. So it became, I don't remember the exact etymological history, but I have a footnote linked to it there on the article. But you can see how it started as presbyteros, then it went to presbyter. It changed a little bit, like to priester, I think, in Middle English, and eventually it became what we call now priest. It's the same word. We're still saying presbyter. But for us, what does that word presbyter now mean? The word means someone who offers sacrifice, because we say priest, that's someone who offers sacrifice. So why is this significant? Well, it's significant because the meaning of the word has been invested with this sacrificial significance over time by the Church of Christ, precisely because that's what a presbyter does. A presbyter offers sacrifice. He offers the sacrifice of the Eucharist. And so that's why that's significant, and we can really easily get confused with the terminology and what the words mean. We're not concerned with the words themselves per se. We're concerned with the realities to which those words are pointing. And so to return to the question of the sacrificial priesthood and why it's important to talk about that with holy orders, I quote Calvin in the article as saying something like, you know, Christ didn't institute priests to immolate victims. He instituted ministers to share the word. So something like that. That's a paraphrase. But so Calvin sort of sees that to offer sacrifice is sort of in conflict with preaching the word, that there's an exclusion there. Well, they're not mutually exclusive. One can offer sacrifice and preach the word. In fact, offering sacrifice is itself preaching the word. This is the gospel message, is to offer sacrifice, is to represent the one-time sacrifice of Jesus Christ on Calvary. That is the gospel. The gospel message is that we are not able to do this. We're not able to achieve salvation. Why not? What do we need to do it? We need the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. So the presbyter or the priest offers that sacrifice, represents the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, and we are to have an internal sacrifice of the heart as well. So it is tied in with the issue of holy orders, I believe.
You claim holy orders is a sacrament. Of course, the church, you quoted Augustine already, this goes way back. When did Christians first start calling holy orders a sacrament? Does it even go back further than St. Augustine?
Well, the word sacramentum, that's what Augustine's really the first one to start using it. And the word Latin, I mean, the Latin theology doesn't go back much further than Augustine anyway. Tertullian's really the first major theologian to write in Latin. And back then, they thought of sacraments a little bit different than we do. They weren't especially concerned with making a list of here's the number of sacraments. They weren't really concerned with explicitly saying here this is a sacrament, this isn't. So we don't see a whole lot of talk about that one way or the other. And that doesn't just go for holy orders. It goes for all the sacraments. And they don't talk much about baptism being a sacrament. They don't talk much about the Eucharist being a sacrament, per se. They don't use those words a whole lot. They do use them, and they use them for holy orders as well. So we saw, St. Augustine said it. He said it in several different places. I've got some of those quotes in the article. Pope St. Leo did as well. Pope St. Gregory, several of the other early church fathers did refer to it as a sacrament. But the point is that the term has sort of evolved in meaning over the years. And, of course, the Greeks, they refer to it as a mystery. And that's really what sacrament means.
Mm-hmm.
One other example is that St. Augustine refers to the Lord's Prayer as a sacrament. And he, as well as some of the medieval theologians, refer to Old Testament sacraments. So there was a much broader use of the term throughout the church history. Of course, Trent nailed down that there were seven sacraments. Holy orders was among them. But Trent was by no means the first church first authoritative council to do this. There were several others. I've got some lists of them on in the article. And all this happened, you know, several hundred years before the Protestant Reformation. So, you know, by the time the reformers came around, it was already a settled deal that there were seven sacraments in the church. And this had been, you know, it had been known and believed by the faithful for centuries, and largely been understood, maybe not in such precise terms, but had, you know, generally been understood and believed and practiced from the very beginning.
What is the biblical basis for holy orders? What would we appeal to say, okay, this is our rationale biblically for holy orders?
Well, first of all, the biblical model for religious authority is top down. There's no ambiguity there. It's always from the top down. It's never the bottom up. So Martin Luther, his early doctrine on holy orders was a sort of bottom up. The governors received their authority, derived their authority by the assent of the governed, sort of like a modern democracy. So the congregation, it was the authority of the congregation that elected and conferred their authority as the priestly people to one minister or several ministers who were going to be the clergy. And if those clergy stopped faithfully preaching the word, the congregation who gave them the authority in the first place could depose them. We see the exact opposite, of course, in St. Clement's letter to Corinthians. Clement says you don't have the authority to do that. And we also see in the scriptures, that's never the case. We never see the congregation ordaining someone on their own authority. What we see is that authority in the scriptures was a top-down model. So we have, you know, Moses, Joshua, all the judges, the Israelite kings, the prophets, Jesus Christ, the disciples, all of these were either, well, in the case of Jesus, he's God himself, he doesn't need to be ordained. But in the other cases, we always see that these men had their authority either directly from God, or they were ordained or commissioned by someone else who had received that authority directly from God. So there's always authority that comes from God. It never comes from the bottom up. The people don't just get together and say, we're going to create some authority for ourselves or for one person. It doesn't work like that. So that's the main thing. Now, of course, the other big important aspect to notice about the biblical basis is the Old Testament model for religious authority is when Moses ascends Mount Sinai to receive the old law and establish the old priesthood. So he doesn't go up by himself. The people, the congregation, stay at the bottom. They don't go up to God. Only Moses, acting as high priest, goes up. So Moses goes up. He also takes with him Aaron and his sons. And they also take 70 elders. And they ascend, so only Moses goes all the way up, but Aaron is down below, and then the 70 elders. And this is an image of what we, in fact, see with the church, right? We see a tiered hierarchy, orders within the hierarchy, with the high priest at the top. Of course, that's the bishop. And then around him are elders, or presbyters. And then below them are the deacons. And so there's a tiered system, a hierarchy. And this is the biblical model. It's simply the biblical model for church authority. So Jesus, when he establishes the priesthood, the new priesthood, he ascends a mountain to do that in Mark chapter 3. So Jesus went up to a mountain, he called to him those who he wanted, and he selected 12 and appointed them as apostles. And why did he do that? It was so that they could go out and to preach and to have authority to drive out spirits. So he was giving them the mission to do the exact same thing that he was doing. He was commissioning them to do the kingdom work. So he ascended a mountain. That's significant. It means something that he did that. And Luke tells us that there was not just the 12, there were also 70 others that he appointed. And why did he use this number 70? It goes back, again, to the account of Moses and the 70 elders of Israel. So the scriptures are making it very clear. And the parable of the vineyard expresses this quite well. The wicked tenants of the vineyard are being thrown out because they haven't been faithful. But the vineyard still persists. So the people of God still goes on. It's just that the owner is reestablishing that leadership. Okay, the old tenants didn't do it right. I'm reestablishing it with a new leadership. So at the Eucharist, the Last Supper, Jesus, you know, commissions the disciples to do this in memory of me. And then after that, he says, I confer on you a kingdom as the Father gave the kingdom to me. And you will sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. What's he doing? He's establishing the disciples, the apostles, as the new heads of Israel, the people of Israel. These are the new heads of the people of God. In John chapter 20, the risen Christ appears to the disciples. He breathes the Holy Spirit on them. He says, I send you as the Father sent me. So again, they're sending them to continue his mission. And then at Pentecost, this is the birth of the church. So remember, Moses had ascended a mountain to receive the old law and establish the old priesthood. Jesus ascended a mountain to establish the new priesthood, right? And on Pentecost, was the descent from the mountain. So Moses came down carrying the old law with the Ten Commandments written on tablets of stone. And St. John Chrysostom says that the disciples didn't come down from the mountain on Pentecost carrying tablets of stone. They came down with the Holy Spirit in their heart, having become a living law, a living book. They have become they are descending the mountain of their ordination, of the establishment of the new law, of the new priesthood. They descend to the people as the new leaders of the people of God, and they carry with them the authority of the Holy Spirit. And so that's the biblical basis for holy orders right there, that Jesus established the apostles with authority for reason, and they delegated that authority to their successors, and we'll talk about that in our next article on apostolic succession.
Well, Tim, there's an article on PCAhistory.org by Don Clements on ordination, and I just want to read to you the quote, and then I want to hear your feedback on this. Clements writes, "The whole discussion rampant in British and U.S. circles concerning the validity of orders is a moot point. For validity must refer absolutely to the fact that it is Christ the Lord who truly ordains. There is no need to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that the source of ordination can be traced without a break to the apostles, as if in fact anyone can really do that." And then he goes on to add, "But we must also apply this to the other extreme and say that self-ordination, or ordination by those with no qualifications within the church, is also not biblical. Christ has passed the keys of the kingdom to his church." End quote. What do you think about that?
Well, there's a couple problems. The first problem is that he makes a point that holy orders really isn't important. It's not really important that you prove that you were ordained by validly. I mean, you were ordained by someone who had the authority to ordain you. In other words, it doesn't have to go back all the way to the apostles, whatever. Well, in fact, there is a biblical importance in that. Remember, I don't know if you remember a certain guy named Korah in the Old Testament. You remember what happened to him?
Yeah. Things didn't turn out so well for him.
No.
And I think that was also some bottom-up stuff, too, going on there, right? Hey, we got this guy. He's going to replace you, Moses.
That's exactly what happened. And in fact, they used almost the exact same argument that most Protestants use now. They say, hey, wait a minute. You say you're a priest, but God made all of us priests, right? He made us all holy. We're a priestly people. And that's true. We are, you know, a priestly people. The nation of Israel was, and so was the church. But that doesn't mean that God didn't appoint some specific leaders, namely Moses in the Old Testament and Korah, who did not have the authority to do what he did, set himself up apart from the church, apart from the succession, the rightfully appointed leaders. And it didn't turn out well for him. The ground opened up and swallowed him. And then he had 250 followers, and they were consumed by fire. And then remember, after that, the next day, people complained about it. They were like, oh, that was kind of harsh. So then the whole community got struck with the plague, and almost 15,000 people died from a plague because they were complaining that God really shouldn't have killed Korah because he was just doing what he thought was right. No, this is serious business. If you're not appointed, you know, if you're not a validly ordained minister, then to set yourself up as a priest or as a bishop is to set yourself up in opposition to the church, because there is only one church, just as there's only one body of Christ, there's only one bride of Christ. So that's the first point I would make, that there is a biblical precedent, a strong biblical precedent, that you can't do that. You can't establish yourself outside of the authority of the rightful leaders that God has established. And the second part is that he says that, well, the other extreme is wrong too. You can't just set yourself up outside of any kind of ecclesial body, right, or something like that. So he's basically saying that Tom, me, and you couldn't get together and have coffee one day and decide that, hey, we're going to start our own church, and then I elect you as the priest for the church. He's saying, well, that would be wrong, I guess. I'm assuming he would say that you can't do that. But he can't offer any principled reason for that, obviously. It's completely completely subjective on how he would judge that.
It's arbitrary.
Yeah, it's arbitrary. That's
what it is. I mean, you call it what it is. It's arbitrary. I mean, who gets to decide?
Right. What makes, you know, we're two or more gathered, right? We're two. And what difference does it make if we have two or we have, you know, 500? Let's say we convince 500 people to come with us and we're going to start our own church. What would make that invalid? And we would, you know, establish our own leaders. Why would that be an invalid thing? You know, when church is defined as whoever teaches the right doctrine, that's an entirely subjective definition of church. So as long as the people who teach the right doctrine elect a leader, then it's a valid leader. But if they teach the wrong doctrine and they elect a leader, then it's invalid, I guess. But that's entirely subjective and it's arbitrary. It's a really weak point. So that's, I guess, my reaction off the cuff to hearing that quote.
Well, what are the implications? What are, you know, on the ground implications of the historical facts regarding holy orders?
Well, the basic implication is that if there are leaders who are, you know, rightfully ordained, and then there's leaders who are not rightfully ordained, if there is such a thing, if there is a real difference between those two, as I have argued in the paper, then guess which one of those we need to be subject to? It's the ones who are rightfully ordained. So in other words, if we're subject to a pastor or a presbytery or whatever that is not rightfully ordained by a Catholic bishop, then they don't have authority, and you're not actually subject to them. They have no authority to excommunicate you. Now, for example, the PCA or some of the Reformed denominations are, you know, of course they believe that, you know, we can excommunicate you from the church, and Baptists, there's several Baptist churches believe that too. You know, most of the evangelical sort of free churches might rarely or never do that, but, you know, Presbyterian church would excommunicate you from the church. Some of the people I know who have converted from Presbyterian churches have been excommunicated because they converted to the Catholic Church. But what does that excommunication mean? If Jesus did ordain, if he did in fact ordain certain leaders, and these are the rightfully ordained men, the successors to the apostles, if he gave the keys to somebody in particular, if he gave the authority to bind and loose to the apostles, and not to just anybody who happened to be really smart and could figure out the Bible, if he gave it to a particular set of people, and they in turn passed that on to others, then only they have the authority to bind and loose. Only they have the authority to excommunicate. If you're not validly ordained as a bishop, you can't excommunicate somebody from the church, because you're not, no one gave you that right. Just as I can't fire somebody from Microsoft, because I don't have that right. I don't belong to Microsoft. I'm not an employee. I'm not a manager or anything. But, you know, you and I could get together and say, hey, we're Microsoft, and then have another person join us, and then they disagree with us, and I say, you're fired from Microsoft. Well, that don't work like that, because I don't have the authority to do that. I'm not really firing them from Microsoft, because I don't have the authority to do that. So
we might get hit with a major lawsuit from Mr. Gates, too.
Yes, there might be some other implications for doing that sort of thing. And just as there might be, there will be serious implications for anyone who knowingly, you know, participates in a church or in an ecclesial community that has deliberately set itself up outside of the church. If you knowingly do that, then you're committing a mortal sin, and it's very serious. So the implications are extremely important for holy orders, and this sort of lays the foundation for our next article, which will be on apostolic succession.
Well, Tim, it's, you know, as usual, the time seems to just fly right by when we do these things. But as we wrap this up, I think it's important for all of us to consider by what authority and on what authority does your pastor operate? You know, did he get his credentials from a group meeting in a house church one day, and they decided to file as a not-for-profit ecclesial religious organization with the Internal Revenue Service? And just because they happen to subscribe to a certain doctrine that suits you, that you find compatible with what you believe is biblical? Is that valid authority? Is that legitimate authority? Is that biblical authority? These are real questions for us to think about. I know certainly for myself, having been ordained in the Presbyterian Church in America, I would ask myself, obviously, as I came into the Catholic Church, by what authority did my presbytery ordain me? A legitimate question, because this goes all the way back to John Calvin. By what authority did he do what he did? Could he just say, well, I'm an ecclesial officer, I have this authority? We see the PCAHistory.org website, Mr. Clemens, when he writes, we don't need to go back to try to figure out if we got our authority from the apostles. And I think there's a reason why he says that, because he can't. He cannot prove that he has his authority tracing all the way back to apostolic lineage. But on the other hand, he wants to say that we just can't self-ordain ourselves, or we just can't get a group together and ordain somebody from amongst us. Well, who says? Brothers and sisters, these are real questions. And at Call to Communion, we want to invite people who seek the truth, in love, because there's no greater calling for us than to be united in the truth, because truth is living, truth is Christ. Join us next time as we gather together to talk more about these great issues facing the church.
This has been a Called to Communion podcast. Visit us on the web at www.calledtocommunion.com. O Sana.